Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Insider Trading and Sufficiency of the Evidence Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 5th, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Salmon v. United States. Bassem Yaqub Salmon was convicted in a jury trial of conspiracy to commit securities fraud, as well as several counts of actual securities fraud. The government's theory was that Salmon, whose brother-in-law Munir Kara, along with Munir's older brother Maher Kara, worked for Citigroup, had coordinated with Munir in an insider trading scheme that, over the course of just a few years, grew a $396,000 brokerage account controlled by Salmon into one worth more than $2 million. Salmon moved for a new trial, arguing that there was no evidence he knew that the tipper had disclosed confidential information in exchange for a personal benefit. The district court denied the motion. Salmon made a similar argument to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit on appeal, urging the court to adopt the then-recently established standards set out by the Second Circuit in United States v. Newman. Under Newman, the government must present sufficient evidence that the accused knew the inside information he received had been disclosed in breach of a fiduciary duty. Invoking its precedent in Dirks v. SEC, the Ninth Circuit rejected Salmon's challenge, holding that the close familial relationship between Salmon and the Karas was sufficient to sustain Salmon's convictions. The question now before the Supreme Court is whether the personal benefit to the insider that is necessary to establish insider trading under Dirks requires proof of an exchange that is objective, consequential, and represents at least a potential gain of a pecuniary or similarly valuable nature, as the Second Circuit held in Newman, or whether it is enough that the insider and the tippy shared a close familial relationship, as the Ninth Circuit held here. To discuss the case, we have Thea Brooke Knight, who is Associate Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Knight.
In Salmon v. U.S., the Supreme Court will consider for the first time in 20 years the question of what constitutes insider trading. The central issue is whether there is insider trading if the insider who provided the information got no tangible benefit in return. The court has never directly ruled on this issue, although it has made statements that are arguably dicta in one case and has expressly reserved the issue in another. The facts in this case revolve around three men. Maher and Munir, who goes by Michael, are brothers. Bassem Salmon is their brother-in-law. Maher worked for Citigroup, focusing on healthcare. Maher is, in the language of insider trading law, the alleged tipper. He disclosed material, non-public information to his brother, who traded on it, and who also passed the information along to Salmon, who also traded on it. These disclosures happened over a period of time and under three different conditions, which could be relevant to the court's decision. So first, Maher disclosed information while seeking Michael's help with some scientific concepts, because Michael has a degree in chemistry. Second, he disclosed information while the brothers were discussing treatment options for their father, who was very sick. And third, Michael asked Maher for some help. He asked him for some money, and Maher gave him the information instead, presumably with the understanding that Michael would trade on it. At some point, it seems Maher became aware of the fact that Michael was trading on the information, although when he figured it out does not seem to be entirely clear. So the question before the court is whether Salmon's actions should be considered insider trading, where Maher received no tangible benefit from either Michael or Salmon in exchange for the information. There's a basic fact pattern that's almost universally accepted as constituting insider trading. If a person who obtains non-public information as a function of holding a position of trust, that would be, for example, either a person actually inside the company, such as an executive, or a person who owes a duty to the company, like a lawyer, uses that information to trade for personal benefit and without the permission of the company, that trade would be considered insider trading. And no one would seriously dispute that. But say the person herself doesn't trade. So the insider doesn't trade for herself, but instead hands the information to a friend and says, I can't trade on this, but will you trade for me and give me the money? Clearly, if we're going to have a law against insider trading, this has to count, because otherwise there's no way to totally prevent somebody from doing this. But after that, it gets kind of murkier. So how far does this go? Does it apply to any trading on non-public information? Well, no. The court has said in a case called Chiarella v. United States, and again in Dirks v. SEC, that it's not going to take that tack. So in the first case, Chiarella worked for a financial printer and obtained information by reading materials that came through his company. The court ruled that because Chiarella had no duty to the companies whose materials he was handling, he had no duty to disclose the information before trading on it. Insider trading is more than just trading on non-public information. It usually is considered to arise out of a breach of duty to the owner of the information that's the basis of the trades. So if an attorney accidentally drops a merger agreement on the street and a passerby picks up the document and trades on the information, that is not considered insider trading, although probably the attorney will be fired for being so careless. But on the other hand, if the attorney himself traded on the information, that would count as insider trading because the attorney has a duty to the client. So in Dirks, a broker-dealer had received a tip from an insider to the effect that there was fraud at this particular company. Dirks investigated the allegations and in the process of his investigation also shared his understanding of this fraud with some clients who used the information to trade. He also contacted the Wall Street Journal and urged them to run a piece on this. They ultimately declined because they thought that it was impossible that such widespread fraud could exist without being detected and were concerned that they would be subject to a libel suit if they actually published that. So the court found that Dirks had not committed insider trading. It relied heavily on Chiarella and found that because the purpose of insider trading is, quote, to eliminate the use of inside information for personal advantage, the test must be whether the insider will personally benefit directly or indirectly from his disclosure. Absent some personal gain, the court said, there has been no breach of duty to stockholders. And this is very important. This is that personal gain piece that we're talking about in Salmon. So because the purpose of the breach in Dirks was to uncover fraud, the court found that no insider trading violation had occurred. So if we go back to our example of the insider sharing information, if the insider gives the information to a friend and says not, you know, trade and give me the money, but trade on this information and in exchange for me doing this for you, buy me a Maserati, that's still insider trading. So in that case, the tipper is essentially buying the car with the information. It's not functionally different from trading on the information herself and then using the money to buy the car. But what if instead our insider wanted something less tangible, something that she couldn't just go out and buy? What if she makes the following offer? Here is inside information that you can trade on, and in exchange, admit me to your exclusive club or send me lots of business. So this typically is considered to count as insider trading. Dirks includes language that would include each of these. In some instances, the court said there may be a relationship between the insider and the recipient that suggests a quid pro quo from the latter. So in each of these examples, we see this quid pro quo. The language in Dirks goes further, however, and says that there may be a relationship that suggests not just a quid pro quo, but, quote, an intention to benefit the particular recipient, end quote. And this piece is important to the Salmon case. There is no claim that Maher got anything at all from either Michael or Salmon. But Maher did testify that he provided the information, at least in some instances, to Michael to, quote, benefit him and provide for his needs. So this may be the trickiest issue for Salmon. Dirks includes express language about gifts. The court in Dirks mused, quote, the elements of fiduciary duty and exploitation of non-public information also exist when an insider makes a gift of confidential information to a trading relative or friend. The tip and trade resemble trading by the insider himself, followed by a gift of the profits to the recipient, end quote. The tippers in that case, the court noted, received no monetary or personal benefit for revealing the fraud, nor was their purpose to make a gift of valuable information to Dirks. This language in Dirks can be read, however, as not central to the holding and arguably dicta. The question in Salman is whether Maher's general beneficence toward his brother would constitute a sufficient benefit to himself so that it would satisfy Dirks' requirement that the insider has received some personal gain in order for his disclosure to qualify as a breach of duty to stockholders. So, one feature of the proscription on insider trading in our law is that there's no statute that expressly forbids insider trading. Instead, it's a crime that developed through the last, say, 50 years of jurisprudence as a form of prescription in the Securities Exchange Act against the use of any manipulative or deceptive device in connection with the purchase or sale of the security. And an oral argument, Salman's counsel highlighted this fact, urging the court to define the scope of the crime narrowly, given the separation of powers issues at play, since this crime has been fairly, pretty much judge-developed out of this part of the statute. So she also alluded several times to the difficulty in defining the crime given the lack of statutory language. But the court, however, all but dismissed Salman's argument, pointing to several decades of case law that have provided at least as much definition as a statute might. Instead, the court was interested in the parties' recommendations for how to delineate when a disclosure is indeed the kind of breach that leads to insider trading, and when it is perhaps a violation of duty, but not insider trading. So Salman argued in favor of a pecuniary gain test, in which the insider must receive something that is either actually cash or can be converted into cash in the future. The crime, his counsel argued, should be limited to trading by the insider or its functional equivalent where the insider tips another person in exchange for a financial benefit. Under this definition, presumably a job opportunity would suffice, since it's something that ultimately has a financial benefit. The rationale behind this argument is that the reason the tippy liability exists is that the insider should not be able to circumvent the law by passing the information to another person to trade in her stead. If the insider receives something of financial value, it's as if she traded herself and then bought the item with the proceeds. While there's some merit to this argument, and it may well be the best choice from a policy perspective, it does still raise some questions. For example, how would you deal with a situation in which the new job opportunity is lower paying but more personally fulfilling? Are we going to have that qualify as counting? The government, on the other hand, argued for a position that could be considered, as Justin Kagan put it, quote, taking this way out of existing law. The government's position is that if an insider discloses information to another person with the knowledge that that person will trade on it, the insider has committed insider trading. Regardless of whether the insider gets anything in return, regardless of whether the insider has any kind of relationship with the putative tippee at all. Earlier in the government's argument, before counsel had explicitly stated this argument, the Chief Justice asked whether it would be insider trading if an insider was, for example, supposed to go away for the weekend with friends, but said, I can't go, I've got this Google thing. And that meant something to the people who heard it, and then they went and traded on it. According to the government, this would not be insider trading if the insider who said this didn't know that the others would trade on the information. But Justice Alito, remarking that the government's argument was not that much more consistent with Dirks than Salman's, posed the following hypothetical. If an insider is walking down the street and sees someone who looks sad and unhappy and gives the person information to help make that person's day, saying, you know, here, take this information, trade on it, you'll make some money and you can be happier, is that insider trading? And the government said yes. That would be insider trading regardless of the fact that the individuals are strangers to each other. And the government's position might add some clarity in that there wouldn't be any examining relationships to determine whether the individuals are sufficiently close that the transfer of information should constitute a gift. And this was the subject of a case that came out of the Second Circuit recently called Newman, where the Second Circuit essentially said, even though information was passed among these different people, and they traded on it, the relationships that they had were not sufficiently close, and the different favors that they provided to each other, just sort of in passing, didn't qualify as this quid pro quo that is required under Dirks. But this position also muddies the waters in another way. While it might add a certain clarity, it also means that now what the courts are going to be doing is trying to look inside the mind of the insider to say, did that person know that the person that they're giving them information to is going to be trading? And that can present its own problems, not only in terms of evidentiary issues, but also in terms of the individual knowing whether they're committing a crime or not. So ultimately, these arguments highlight the underlying issue when it comes to insider trading law. No one knows quite what the law is supposed to do. Counsel for the government opened his argument by highlighting the risk that Salmon's proposed test would allow a corporate insider to parcel out valuable information to favored friends, family members, and acquaintances who could use it, quote, without the knowledge of the public or the investors on the other side of the trade, end quote. This suggests that the principal harm insider trading seeks to prevent is a kind of fraud on the trading public. But if that were really the issue, it seems like Chiarella would have gone the other way. So why was it fair for Chiarella to have knowledge that the rest of the market didn't have, regardless of where that knowledge came from? But the court expressly rejected a rule that would make any trading at all based on non-public information illegal. And then, although the government led with this argument about essential fairness, much of the rest of the argument focused on ownership of the information. This falls under the exclusive use theory of insider trading, which holds that the owner of the information has a right to the exclusive use of it. But in that case, any disclosure for personal use should trigger liability, whether or not the person disclosing knew the disclosure would lead to trading. So in the course of argument, the government said that some of these disclosures by Maher might not actually have triggered insider trading if he didn't know that Michael was going to trade on the information. So for example, when he was seeking help from Michael on scientific concepts, or when he was disclosing information as part of the discussion about how to help their father, these would not be insider trading under the government's theory, assuming that Maher didn't know that Michael planned to trade on these. But at that point, you still have Maher using this information illegally. So in the background of these legal issues, there's another consideration which makes the legal issues a little bit trickier and might lead to some of this ambivalence about what the actual purpose of insider trading law is. And that's that there are these policy considerations about the role of information in the marketplace. There has been considerable discussion in the academic literature of whether there should be insider trading law at all. A point that Salmon's counsel made in the course of her argument about this ongoing debate. One of the key functions of markets is price discovery. This requires a constant flow of accurate information to the markets. If an announcement will happen tomorrow that will significantly impact the price of a security, it would be better for the market if the information became known today so that the securities could better reflect their true value. This consideration has always been held in the balance with the consideration of fairness, whether it's to the markets as a whole, the counterparties to particular trades, issuers, or other players in these cases. So, in summary, to reach a decision that sets forth a coherent rule, the court might first need to determine what the purpose of insider trading law really is. And that's something that, as I've said, has remained somewhat murky, that there has been these different conflicting theories that seem to come out in the course of different arguments. But because of this confusion, it's been difficult to articulate a clear rule. And in some cases, it seems like, unfortunately, some of the decisions have been driven more by the facts than perhaps a clear rule. So, for example, in Dirks was trying to uncover fraud, and so it would have been difficult, perhaps, to hold him liable for something where there was this good underlying purpose. In another case, O'Hagan, that was a case where there's some argument that there wasn't an existing theory before that case that would support a conviction for O'Hagan. But in that case, O'Hagan was an attorney who had embezzled client funds and then was using client information in order to get money that would help cover his embezzlement. And, you know, there is a coherent theory that you can apply to this that has the result in Dirks and O'Hagan that we wound up with. But sometimes when you try to bring it all back together, it becomes very difficult to articulate an overall rule. So hopefully what will come out of Salmon, if nothing else, is some certainty in this area, where there is a rule that makes it easy for individuals to know whether they're breaking the law or not, which is always a good thing, and also some sort of coherent sense of who the victim is in insider trading.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.